AI seems to be all that many, and especially Microsoft, want to talk about these days. But Exchange has to be a close second, especially with Microsoft focusing more on trying to secure it as of late. We at Direction still get a lot of questions from our members and from our readers about what's happening with Exchange. So that's the topic of today's podcast. Welcome to the Directions on Microsoft Briefing podcast. I'm Mary Jo Foley, the editor-in-chief here at Directions. I'm your host for the series of podcasts designed for those interested in the Microsoft Enterprise IT ecosystem. I've got not one, but two guests today to talk about Exchange with me, Tony Redmond and Rob Helm. Tony is the lead author for the Office 365 for IT Pros ebook, which is updated monthly to keep pace with the cloud, and which includes a separately bundled 400-page book about PowerShell for the Microsoft Graph. He is also the owner and principal of Redmond & Associates, a consulting company that specializes in helping people understand the impact of cloud technology. Rob Helm is the managing vice president here at Directions. His 25-plus years of experience analyzing Microsoft technology and strategy allows him to discern the company's overall directions and sometimes confusing and contradictory signals that it sends to customers and the industry. Welcome, both of you. I am just going to go right into the questions because we have a lot of them today. So let's start big picture. We know that Microsoft and everyone else has been trying to take over company communications with chat, voice, video, and so on. But nothing still has matched the reach of email. So I'm curious if you think there's any next-gen communication coming along that could change this. Let's start with Tony, and then let's have Rob chime in. Tony?
Thank you, Mary Jo. I guess the great value of email is that you can reach anybody with an email address, a simple SMTP address your way. And the thing that strikes me about the other communication systems that are out there that people are trying to use, like Teams and Slack, is that they're intensely internally focused, which means that it's absolutely they're great platforms for communication, for chatting, for sharing information, be it videos or files or whatever or whatnot. But they're only really with people in your walled garden, which you could define in this case as anybody who within your tenant or anybody who's been added as a guest account added to your tenant. These platforms inherently are less good about connecting to the wider internet. And, you know, there's good and bad things about that. Because, like, the downside of email that's been hijacked so often by spammers and, you know, infected with malware and phishing happens all the time. And that's really because email is so open and so connectable. It's very prone to being exploited by bad people. But what's really interesting is that when Microsoft launched Teams, which is back in November 2016 and then generally available in early 2017, they really talked about open communications and all of that, and so that you could go reach out and have federated chats with people and tenants everywhere. And since then, they've discovered that just doesn't work in the modern internet because of social engineering attacks coming in to try and trick people so that their accounts can become compromised and all of that. And right. So many changes have been made since then to stop or control external communications coming into Teams. And that reflects the state of threat in the real world. I mean, the latest addition is, which we talked about just before the show started, is these trust indicators, which now show up beside people's names, right, which are really just visual signs to say, hey, you know, guess what? This person is from outside of the tenant. Now, whether or not people actually pay any attention, apart from saying they're bloody awful and disgustingly bad icons, they say, oh, that person might be dangerous. I better not chat too much with them or whatever. I don't know. But it's similar in the way that Exchange highlights emails from external people. Mm-hmm. I think one last thing I'd say about this is that it's really interesting to me that Microsoft said that Teams had 320 million monthly active users in October 2023, but they haven't given us a number since. Mm. I just wonder if the Teams juggernaut has run out of steam a little bit, Despite the liberal lashings of co-pilot and agents that have been bestowed on teams. In fact, you know, I'd say some of the best co-pilot implementations are in teams like Meeting Notes and the Facilitator Agent, both of which use the meeting transcript. But, you know, I just wonder, is there an upper limit on what these communication systems can do?
I know. I wonder the same thing. Whenever they stop giving out statistics on something, there's a reason, right? It's not arbitrary.
Oh, that's right. And they've been so proud of being able to hype the growing numbers of teams.
Exactly.
But, you know, the thing is that there's always an upper limit for these. And as I said, they're internally focused systems.
Yeah.
And when you've only got 440 million Microsoft 365 paid seats, I mean, it's like 80% penetration.
Right, exactly. What do you think, Rob? Is there something that's going to be bigger than email? Email does, we use email all the time inside Directions still.
Well, for a time, I thought that enterprise chat, Slack, and Teams was going to be the successor to email. And I still wouldn't completely rule it out, but I'm just struck by the vendors themselves. Each has built its moat around its own customer base. And they've never kind of reached the point that email made where it was almost universal service. I mean, I think email arrived, internet email at least, at a unique period in time, backed by a national government and an entire country full of researchers. It spread like kudzu, and now I don't think there's anybody who can match that in the near term. That said, I on my own home domain, I'm shocked to see how many WhatsApp messages have gone by and how more and more of my in-laws, for example, are using it. I just have a feeling if chat is ever going to take off, it's going to be something that develops in the consumer realm, not enterprise. But because it's from the consumer realm, there's always going to be the issue of identity. I think any communication protocol has to have a reliable identity infrastructure, and we just still don't have it on the scale of something like the internet. And if you don't know who you're talking to, it kind of changes everything.
It does, indeed. All right.
I'm so disappointed that Rob isn't using Teams Personal or Teams for the Home rather than WhatsApp.
Is anyone using Teams Personal? I don't know. I don't know a single person using it, I don't think. But
well, it's funny. I just wrote a piece about the latest version of Windows 11, and one of the most exciting features was the ability to get rid of Teams Personal.
There you have it. All right. We've started talking a little bit about security, so let's go there, right? Like, I want to talk about spam because I get this question all the time, especially on Twitter. I get people saying to me, what the heck is going on with Exchange and spam? And I have multiple inboxes on different Exchange services, but I have had a ton of problems lately with my personal business account on Exchange Online with spam. It's just like inundating my inbox. So I'm curious, do you think Microsoft can get a handle on this? Is anything they're doing here working? I feel like no at this point. I don't know, but what do you say, Tony?
Have you ever looked at Gmail?
Yeah, I know. Also horrible.
I mean, seriously though, folks, spam comes in waves, and most of the time the level is acceptable, especially if the administrator of your tenant pays a little bit of attention. Yeah. And, you know, Mary Jo, I don't have the same type of issue, but then again, I do pay attention to the policies that are used to protect my tenant. And I've blocked a huge number of domains, and I continue to block domains as I notice spam coming from those domains. And I also look at quarantine to make sure that I haven't blocked any false positives and all that sort of stuff. And the point here is that if tenant administrators know what they're doing and they stay on top of the defenses that are available in Microsoft Online Protection, and especially Microsoft Defender for Office 365, it is possible to squash a large percentage of spam.
Okay.
Some spam will always get through. And and you know what? New evasion techniques will be developed. That's just the way it's been since day zero of spam. It's a fact of email life. I don't think we'll ever get to a point where you're not going to be annoyed by spam, because there are some very intelligent people out there thinking of new techniques to infect you. And it's going to be a bit like COVID. You know, it's always likely to pop up and infect unless you're careful. And to be fair to Microsoft, and I realize that is a leading statement, but the Exchange team, I think, does their best to close off the routes used by spammers to infect mail servers and also to leverage mail servers as spam generators. I mean, some of the decisions that they've made have not been popular.
Right.
For example, in hybrid environments, Microsoft stops old Exchange servers connecting to Exchange Online to transmit email via connectors. And that's because, you know what, before they did that, they found that there were lots of very old servers out there that are connected to Exchange Online that weren't protected and were just perfect vectors for absolute rubbish that came into Exchange Online. So when Microsoft moved to insist on supported servers for the on-premises side, boy, there was squeals of pain everywhere. But, you know, it seems to have been a good tactic and has forced companies to think about keeping their on-prem servers up to date. Mm-hmm. And that really means that those servers that support connectors today have to be Exchange 2019 RSE. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, I think that we've also got to realize that there's a lot of work that's gone on to convince customers to pay more attention to the basics of identifying their email as valid through standards like DMARC, DKIM, and SPIF, SPF. And they've introduced external tagging in all their clients. And, you know, basically, they've also done things like clampdown and trial tenants to stop spammers using these tenants to send spam. They've, you'd love this. You know what a Moira address is?
No. I do not.
It's an onmicrosoft.com address that's given out for a trial tenant.
Yep. Yeah,
those guys now can't send a lot of mail using those Moira addresses. And there's new external recipient limits. So there's a lot going on. And I think going to see over the year, as time goes by, there'll be more and more squeeze to stop spammers using Exchange Online as a platform and also to stop spammers getting stuff into the platform.
Okay. Well, you already answered part of my question. So you said it's only as good as the administrators who are managing it. I'm the administrator on my account and I don't manage it. So there we go.
I didn't want to call you incompetent.
It's okay. I just called myself incompetent.
That's your privilege and right.
Rob, what do you say? I think you manage our email, don't you, at Directions?
Speaking as a reformed spammer myself.
Okay.
I have since sworn off of it, I swear. I think it's always been spam quickly reached 90%+ of the traffic and has never looked back from when email started. And Microsoft has been, I think, I agree with Tony that it's been one of the leaders in getting people to adopt, for example, domain authentication technology. So at least we know which internet domain it's coming from and we can make reasonable decisions on that. This is also an area where I feel like Microsoft and Google are, I wouldn't say colluding, but maybe inspiring one another so that Google will roll out a new protective technology, Microsoft will eventually follow, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. So between the two of them, I think they've locked down a lot of just the sheer number of accounts out there. And I agree with Tony, Microsoft has adopted things, apart from what he already mentioned, there's quite a few capacity constraints Microsoft's introducing to prevent people from sending large volumes of email through Exchange Online. It of course, is to Microsoft's interest to limit capacity because then it can charge you for higher capacity. But nonetheless, it has, I think it also put some limits on Microsoft originating spam. And so I think it's always going to be with us, but I think we've got to handle it. Oh, well, the last thing is there are also still some pretty decent third parties out there. And it was actually the third parties that made my life difficult when I was a unreformed spammer.
I'm going to ask you more about that later. I'm curious. but you know, the other thing we haven't talked about here with the conversation around spam is AI, right? So do you think AI is going to put the spammers permanently ahead of the anti-spam services from Microsoft and third parties? Or is it more of like a double-edged sword? Who wants to start there?
Why would you think that?
I don't know. I feel like AI.
I'll admit, I kind of lean toward this a bit. Just it's the ability to generate very convincing looking content right. very quickly. A lot of the anti-spam technologies rely on engagement. And so if you can fool a user into opening the email, scrolling, et cetera, then the mail suddenly starts to become more credible in the eyes of Microsoft and Google and the other spam filters. That's why I was curious. Mm-hmm. Or it could be that the ability to generate credible looking mail suddenly gives people a cheat code to get past the filters.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it probably AI lowers the entry bar for people who want to be spammers. They don't need as much expertise now anymore to create good looking spam email. But I mean, the thing about AI as we have it today, generative AI depends on what's gone before. It's not going to create new techniques. It's not going to create new vectors for attack in the same way as human spammers have been so successful since the I Love You virus came out in May 2000. I think it's the humans that will drive the development of new techniques that will get past defenses. And it's humans that will figure out, maybe with the help of AI, how best to suppress those new attack vectors. But I'm not sure that, I don't think it's going to put spammers ahead of AI services, or I don't think it's going to suppress them totally. This is just going to be an ongoing battle between the good guys and the bad guys, just as it has been for the last 25 years.
Yeah. And before that, you know, armor versus artillery, for example.
There you go.
Well,
that's a bit outmatched, isn't it?
Sorry?
Just saying.
All right. I'm going to switch gears here. We've talked enough about spam. Let's talk about something fun, like Exchange SE subscription edition. Curious what you guys think in terms of how it's going. Are people who are running Exchange on premises still getting into this idea now of a subscription model? How's it going? What do you guys think? Tony, you want to start?
Well, I don't think there's such a big deal here. I really don't think there's such a big deal here.
Okay.
Because it seems to me that the first thing is that Exchange SE is basically Exchange 2019, which goes end of lifetime on the 14th of October.
Right.
It's just 2019 with a couple of tweaks. One of the tweaks is a new version number. I mean, that's pretty good, you know, but that's basically Microsoft has made it as easy as possible to get across to SE as they can. So getting to SE is not a technology challenge, provided you've kept your on-premises environment up to date. If you're one of those people, like the guys that the FBI had to help out when half of them came along and they had to fix all those servers, If you're one of those guys, you're probably in a problem. But then again, you're probably not paying Microsoft for any licenses today anyway. So you're the ones I really worry about. The folks that kept their environments up to date, have 2016 latest or 2019 latest, they're going to go across quite easily. And after that, you know, in terms of licensing, well, gee, isn't that your business? I mean, haven't you figured this out yet? Because that's the only thing I hear from people is like, what licenses do we need in the new subscription era?
Yeah.
To which the Microsoft people says, well, you need exactly the same licenses you had on premises. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Anything there to add?
I guess I have a short-term concern and a longer-term concern. The short-term concern is just a lot of people have not actually deployed the thing yet. And I'm concerned that they will not make the deadline for completing their deployment. There'll be a lot of people hanging out there And if a vulnerability is discovered, it could be a problem, because unlike with Windows 11, for example, there is no so-called extended security updates that you can buy and get fixes for vulnerabilities that come out that hit 2019. That concerns me a little. There is, in fact, a secret extended security updates program for which you have to be 20 feet tall to get in. You have to have a Microsoft account manager. Those are becoming rarer on the ground this year after all the layoffs. And so I could see a crunch where some bad vulnerability comes out. There's no patches and limited help for getting it resolved for smaller organizations. And small is not that small. It could be under 3,000 people, for example. Mm-hmm. Long-term, what worries me a little bit is Microsoft quite reasonably is focusing its development on Exchange Online and also getting rid of, frankly, what it considers legacy technology in Exchange Online. A plan I heard recently is getting rid of Outlook on the Web's technology for logging people out automatically when they're inactive, for example. And no problem. Microsoft 365 has an equivalent technology that's more general and, in general, a better solution. But now, is there anybody going to be left at Microsoft who understands how the original Exchange technology, which is still needed in Exchange SE, is there anybody there who knows how it works? Mm. Is anybody going to be able to work on it if it needs some tweaking? That it concerns me a little bit that Microsoft's Exchange Online and its Exchange SE's priorities and technology are diverging so fast. Mm. Exchange SE may become difficult even for Microsoft to maintain, and that'll translate into less stability going forward. But I'd be interested to hear what Tony thinks of that. Do you think they're going to keep the two in line with each other to the point that Exchange SE is still viable and can talk to Exchange Online as it should?
Well, you raised two points that I think deserve attention there. The first is about some sort of problem appears and, you know, people haven't got to SE. I think if that happens, you'll see a security update from Microsoft, because that's what we're essentially talking about here. If a security problem appears, Microsoft in the past has released security updates for like Exchange 2013 that was out of support at the time. So I think they'll take the same thing. I mean, the point is that, okay, 14th of October comes along, all of a sudden Exchange 2016 and 2019 are out, have reached the end of lifetime. They don't just stop working. They will continue to work. They'll continue to work just fine. And provided that the latest versions of the software are running on servers, I don't have too much heartburn about keeping them there in that state for a couple of weeks while, you know, things have to slot into place to allow a updates. You know, maybe new server hardware has to come and all the rest of it. So I'm not too sure that there's an issue there. Now, the second point that you raised, which is a really important one, is that Exchange SE and Exchange Online, so keeping them aligned. The first thing to say is that Exchange SE and Exchange Online do not have the same code base. They haven't had the same code base for 5 years. They haven't shared the same code base for at least 5 years. In fact, even longer, pre-2019, I think Microsoft made the switch. And that's because there is so much extra code in Exchange Online that just can't run on premises. So many features that are there, you know, the interaction with Teams, for example, the integration with SharePoint, all of that kind of stuff, it's in Exchange Online and it's not going to be on Exchange SE ever. Hmm. So there is already two separate teams that handle Exchange SE and Exchange Online, which I think, by the way, is called Microsoft 365 Messaging Services within Microsoft. It's not called Exchange Online anymore. I mean, you know, that's the way it goes. So will they have engineers that can deal with this diversion? Well, they've been dealing with the diversion for years and years and years. And the thing I think about is that all of this stuff, all of the communication that happened is based on standards, is based on things like OAuth and SMTP. So I don't think there's going to be that kind of a problem. But what I would say is that Exchange SE customers are definitely always going to be the poor cousins in terms of features and functionality. And right. Part of that is a function of the fact that now the on-premises market is much smaller. Part of it is because there are much fewer engineers in Microsoft working on this product. And part of it is because, quite frankly, it's the on-premises technical base, the platform, is so much more limited than what is available in the cloud.
Right.
So okay. There is going to be a steadily widening differentiation between the on-premises and the cloud product. It's been that way since 2016 or thereabout, and you're just going to see it more and more and more grow wider and wider over the years. But that doesn't mean that Exchange SE might not make a 50th anniversary in 21 years time.
Right. I know. If a big customer wants it, they'll keep it, right? So,
well, the thing is that if you're in a submarine, you can't really depend on the cloud, you know. And there are these type of environments where a mail server does that doesn't need an intranet connection is needed.
Right.
Just that's the way it is.
Fair.
Or maybe less extreme. It's just you need physical control of the data center because you're working with classified information.
Or right. Like. Correct.
Correct.
True. All right. I'm gonna stop you two there so I can take a quick break so I can give our listeners a quick reminder. If you are facing a Microsoft renewal or an enterprise agreement negotiation, you do not need to do this alone. Directions on Microsoft's contract and EA negotiation support advisory service, that's a mouthful, gives you expert guidance from people who've sat on both sides of the table, including former Microsoft deal desk execs like Dean Bedwell, who is our lead negotiator here at Directions. Via our advisory service, we can help you spot hidden cost drivers, build a smarter negotiation strategy, and lots more. If you want to learn more about what we provide, go to directionsonmicrosoft.com/get-advice. And if you've got a renewal coming up, feel free to reach out to sales@directionsonmicrosoft.com. Okay, back to All Things Exchange with Tony and Rob. I am curious if you two think we're getting any closer for customers to actually remove the last Exchange server from their hybrid environments. I know Microsoft's got a plan for something called Cloud Managed Remote Mailboxes. It looks kind of complex. Curious if you think it's going to work. Is it too complex to be useful, or what's going on here? Tony, you want to dig in first?
Well, so the only reason you need an Exchange server on-prem today is for if you're using an SMTP relay to the outside world, you want to have that level of control so that all the mail coming out of your organization goes through your servers and not the cloud servers. Mm-hmm. Maybe that you want to pump stuff out to an external mail message hygiene or whatever. Or you want to have graphical UI control over mailboxes that remain on premises, mailboxes that are on premises. Are indeed distribution groups that are on premises and all the rest of it. Now, you know what? We're 14 years down the Office 365 route. I'm not even going to talk about BPOS. So mostly because it was not a very nice product. But but you know, I think we're at the situation where most of the hybrid there's a lot of hybrid customers Lots of hybrid customers. But most of the hybrid customers I talk to have very few mailboxes left on premises. It seems like they have the vast bulk have been moved over in the cloud. They have now successfully managed to get the great cockroaches of Exchange over, which are public folders. They have managed to move their distribution lists, et cetera, et cetera. And really, they're left with a minimal exchange environment. I think that those guys can get rid of their exchange server today, because then they can manage everything using PowerShell, you know, and Microsoft provides that solution. Mm-hmm. The only time you need that exchange server is, as I say, for SMTP, really. In terms of what's happening now, last week or earlier this week, Microsoft started to really ramp up their focus on this source of authority, moving the source of authority away from Active Directory to Entra ID for accounts, for groups, et cetera, et cetera. And they're really charting the way forward to get all these objects over onto Entra ID and to manage them there. And as that goes, as that process unveils and rolls out, deploys, and people start to use it, yeah, there's even less reason to have an exchange server around. Mm. So really, when people start getting worried about removing the last exchange server, I'm kind of looking at them saying, well, you can do that today if you want to, like, you know, just use PowerShell. Mm. But unless you need that SMTP relay.
Okay. Rob?
Yeah, I it's interesting. I still find that customers who are relying on Active Directory, it looks like it's a very heavy lift for them. And the solution that Tony references with PowerShell, it's been out since shortly after 2019 shipped, and there just don't seem to be that many takers. I don't know quite what the barrier is, but having a Microsoft-built solution to manage on-premises directory entries from the cloud, I think may be the final screw that had to be put into place to get people to move. And for Microsoft, it has strong incentive to keep working with this solution and make it work, because it wants everybody off Active Directory, mm-hmm. not just right. for Exchange, but for everything else.
Yeah.
So I think this is the nose of the camel under the tent, as it were. this solution, I think, might be the one that Microsoft sustains and that has some legs and gradually picks off the rest of the hybrid customers who are stuck in that mode just because they're stuck with Active Directory. But it's going to take time, and it's not, again, in the end, it wasn't an exchange problem. It's a directory problem. Mm-hmm. It all comes back to identity once again.
Yep. Okay. Without a doubt. And you know what? Microsoft have got a huge incentive to get people over to the cloud, because once they're over in the cloud, they can sell them all these extra licenses for Entra P1 and P2, Entra ID governance, et cetera, et cetera. You know, not saying that that's why they want to do it, but there is an incentive. We'll say another thing too, though, this about SMTP relays. One of the reasons why people have SMTP relays is that they have apps and devices, multifunction devices like printers, that need to send SMTP mail. Now, Microsoft wants to get rid of SMTP basic authentication from Exchange Online, and they're trying to force people to move away from using SMTP with basic auth from apps and from devices to send email. You know, like your printer job is done, your photocopy of 4,000 copies is done, that type of thing. And the solutions that they're putting out is a thing called HVE, high volume email, which very disappointingly, I think, has been handicapped by the removal of its ability to send external email, limited ability to send external email. HVE is now a purely internal service. Mm-hmm. And if you want to use a service to send external email, you're forced into using the Azure email communication service, which is a paid for service. So again, you know, there's an incentive there for Microsoft to get people over. And that's another reason why people might want to keep an Exchange server. If you've got a lot of outbound message marketing emails and stuff like that, and you've got a lot of apps and you've got a lot of these devices, you may just want to keep that server there to handle all this kind of stuff. I mean, one really, it's interesting that Microsoft has had to push out the date for deprecation of SMTP auth for for basic auth for these devices and such to September 2028, I think is the latest date.
And, oh, is and that that's right? Wow.
Yeah, that speaks to the problem that's out there of finding people who understand the source code of their apps so they can go and change the relatively few lines of code that's required to send email using SMTP basic auth to the larger number, shall I just say it like that? The yep. larger number of lines required to obtain an OAuth access token to be able to identify yourself to the service with that access token, make a connection and send email. It's bad enough with apps, but when you have got these multifunction devices where the code is wired into the firmware of these devices and you're going to go and talk to somebody like somebody who sells printers or somebody who sells multifunction devices and say, hey, guess what? Can I have updated firmware so that I can send email using OAuth? They're going to look at you as you've got two heads and whatever. So there's a big issue around that. And that, I suspect, will be one of the Microsoft has control over accounts. It will get those accounts across. It can't control the apps and it can't control the devices.
Yeah. And so the goal of eliminating that last server, I think it's for some customers, it's going to have to remain a pipe dream because, as Tony mentioned, Exchange Online is also screwing down more and more capacity limits on customers. And so your only solution is going to have to be to have some kind of SMTP capability on premises in some cases.
Okay. Another one I want to talk about is Exchange Web Services, or EWS, in Exchange Online. So Microsoft's announced there's an end of service date for this, October 1st, 2026. So this move impacts lots of applications, plugins, migration tools, all these things that rely on EWS for connectivity. I'm curious what you both would advise customers to be doing at this point about this. Who wants to start with that one?
Tony, do you want to take a shot? You're probably more affected than I am.
Oh, I'm not affected at all. I haven't used Exchange Web Services for years and years and years. But, the point is that there's a bunch of stuff, code out there that does use EWS. So it's just one of this it's a bit like the last server story. It's a legacy baggage that Exchange has been dragging around. You know, the security is the reason why EWS has been retired.
Yep.
EWS was never designed for use in cloud environments. It was always intended that EWS was going to be used inside a closed garden of somebody's internal network. And this is the reason why hackers love EWS, because of its power over complete mailboxes and its simple permissions model. And, you know, Microsoft enjoyed the power of EWS when hackers used it with the Midnight Blizzard exploit. I mean, that's how they were able to enumerate all those executives' mailboxes and extract information from those mailboxes. And this is the reason why very soon after Midnight Blizzard, Microsoft set out in a crusade to retire EWS from Microsoft apps very soon. I believe by the end of 2025, EWS will be gone from all Microsoft apps. I hear it's gone now from lots of places, like, for example, Teams was using EWS to call into Exchange to get information about mail, tips, and calendar, free busy, et cetera, et cetera. Outlook was using EWS. I mean, one of the original Outlook clients for Mac was built on top of EWS. So by the end of 2025, EWS will be gone from all Microsoft apps. That's what I hear. I believe the people that are driving this program, they've gone through this party before, they know what they're doing. And I believe that it will be a great example to ISVs and customers that, yes, it is possible to remove EWS from apps. However, the difficulty that customers and ISVs face is, number one, understanding where EWS is used in their apps. Some people may have forgotten.
Right.
Some people may never have known that they were using EWS because a third-party contractor built something in. You know, they said, we need to be able to send email via Exchange. Will you do that? Certainly will. There you go. There's a subroutine. There it goes. So they need to discover where that code is, who knows the code, and then they need to rewrite the code, and it is a rewrite to the graph.
Okay.
It's not particularly difficult in most cases. There are some legacy properties that Outlook uses in particular that may cause a few more gray hairs to descend, but, you know. But generally speaking, the code to navigate mailboxes, get stuff out of mailboxes, remove stuff from mailboxes, put stuff into mailboxes, that's well known. It's a well-trodden path for the graph.
Okay.
So it shouldn't be difficult. But it's like everything else. Lots of other stuff going on. People have got other stuff to do. And I suspect around about Labor Day 2026, there are going to be some people waking up saying, insert favorite four-letter word here. Yeah. I haven't done this work.
Yes, indeed.
And this All is right. another example of where diverging technologies is going to be important, where killing this in the cloud, killing Exchange Web Services in the cloud is going to drain the pool of people who understand how it works, and then when it comes time to get rid of it on premises, there may be no one left standing.
Right. Okay, I want to end with Tony getting a question from Rob, because Rob has some PowerShell things he wants to ask you. I know you can't wait to answer. So, Rob.
Oh yeah.
Well, sure. I've been enjoying your blog, but also, as you pointed out, PowerShell has proven a way to get out of various kinds of jails, like managing Exchange or managing Active Directory on premises without Exchange on premises. I also noticed that, frankly, the most effective area I've seen generative AI make a difference is in coding. So it just occurred to me, why even bother with management tools as such? I mean, why not turn people loose with PowerShell and ChatGPT or Copilot and a coding extension? Have you found that this kind of so-called vibe coding, does it change what you're able to do in a certain amount of time or the number of people who can do it credibly?
Well, there are two answers to that. The first answer is that GitHub Copilot, that's what I wanted to say. GitHub Copilot is probably the best $10 a month you're ever going to spend for a subscription. It's sometimes annoying. I mean, sometimes GitHub Copilot is like a new puppy leaping up all the time saying, I want to help. I want to write some code for you. And you just have to say, go away. Wait, but it generally speaking, if you're looking for an answer to help, you know, write a function or something like that, GitHub Copilot can save you time. And I use it all the time. I use it inside Visual Studio Code. It seems to me that Copilot has learned how I code badly and is willing to produce the same bad code. So that's pretty good. It looks the same as what I produce, and that's just fine. However, you know, the thing about all of this generative AI is that it's built on a tissue of lies, which is called the internet, because that's how it learned. That's how it learned. I mean, it went out and it learned from all of the stuff that's published out on the internet. And there is some right rubbish PowerShell on the internet. And AI like ChatGPT and Copilot, the Copilot chat, they are both perfectly willing to go and generate code that can never work. They will make up commands. They will make up parameters. They will make up parameter values. They will combine commands together in such a way that could never work in practice. And then you call them on it and say, well, that doesn't work. And they say, oh, sorry. Let me try again. And they go and they try again, and they produce more absolute rubbish. And I am really, really, really careful here not to use the words that I want to use about the quality of this goat. But, you know,
Thank you. It's a family newsletter.
Yes, it's a family newsletter. And I wouldn't like to sully the great reputations that you guys have got at Directions of Microsoft by saying what I think about some of the code that ChatGPT and Copilot can both generate. So I think, in summary, after all of that diatribe, I'd say that GitHub Copilot is worth the $10 a month, absolutely, but it's trust and verify always.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. All right. On those wise words, I'm going to end our podcast today. I want to say thank you to both the guests for a great exchange and PowerShell World Tour. Thank you guys very much.
You're welcome.
I would also like to remind our listeners that they can find lots more coverage of all things Microsoft related on directionsonmicrosoft.com. Thank you so much for listening. If you have questions, comments, or any topics that you would like to hear the directions analysts and guests cover in one of these podcasts, please do not hesitate to contact me via X or Blue Sky. Directions on Microsoft is on LinkedIn as well, so make sure you follow us there. We at Directions have converged our social media channels into a single platform, so give us a follow at DirectionsMSFT on X or Directions on Microsoft on Blue Sky to get all of the latest Microsoft Enterprise product and licensing information. Thank you again.